Jesus goes home. It's an interesting phenomenon to think about. That first time, you know, if you've moved away from home, if you had to go to the big smoke, and that first instance when you go back to your own people, back to your family and friends, and particularly in this kind of situation of having to preach, you know, it's something that most other people, like if you're a famous soccer player or something, you've been practicing in the backyard all of your life, so your parents have seen all of that. If you're a musician, again, they've seen all of those, the fruits of all of the work and the practice that you've put in. But something like preaching is something that's so internal, something that's inside of you, and then suddenly it's outside. You get a bit of a hint at how extraordinary it might be for Jesus to do this before his home crowd on this particular day. But before we get there, I think it's good just to look at where are we in the Gospel of Mark. Now, that's a map of the Holy Land, or the parts of it, certainly. We have the Sea of Galilee in the very north there, and then going down to the Dead Sea and the Rift Valley, the Jordan Valley, going down through the center. Now, the Gospel of Mark begins with this short statement, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, or I prefer to say King Jesus, the Son of God. There's no birth story, there's no story about the way that Jesus was born. None of those details are provided. He jumps straight into the ministry of John the Baptist. John the Baptizer appeared in the wilderness. So Mark 1, verse 4. Then in those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized in the Jordan by John. So that's the first movement that we get in this gospel. Jesus traveling from Nazareth to go down to be baptized by John. And immediately after, he's then sent by the Spirit into the wilderness to spend that period of temptation and testing. I've got Jerusalem up there on the map, but that's only really as a point of reference. Jerusalem doesn't actually appear in the Gospel of Mark until Jesus arrives there the week of Palm Sunday, the week before he dies. That's the first time. It's in Mark 10, verse 42, that we first get the appearance of Jerusalem. It's kind of interesting. And then Mark 1, 14, we're told that Jesus came to Galilee. So let's focus in on the Sea of Galilee and the region of Galilee. Now, the lake, the sea, it's called both things in the scriptures and in common usage. It has a whole range of different names. So it's first called the Lake of Kinneret in the book of Numbers. That's the first time that we see a reference to this body of water. It's also called the Sea of Galilee, the Lake of Gennesaret, Lake Tiberias, it was called by the Romans. It often takes the name of one of the principal towns. So whatever town happens to be significant at that time, so Tiberias was the main town, still is the main town to this day on the shore of the lake. It's also called the Sea of Ginosa. It's another town. It's called that in the Babylonian Talmud. That's a little bit between Capernaum and Tiberias. And in Arabic, it's called the Sea of Minya. It's pretty mountainous around it, as we will see on the next slide. So the whole of the Sea of Galilee, of course, is below sea level. It's about 200 meters below sea level, beginning of that Rift Valley, where the whole of that valley is below, is hundreds of meters below sea level. So you see that on all around it are really hills. So there's about at least 500 meters, these hills. So they're about the, you know, kind of escarpment kind of size hills around it, going up to up in the northwest there, very steep, you know, more than 1,500 meters. So 1,100 meters above the sea level, but so about 1,400 meters above the distance of the Sea of Galilee. So there around Tiberias and a little bit to the north in Capernaum, they're the only kind of habitable larger areas. The rest, it's just a very thin section of land before these steep cliffs around the lake and then to the the south, which is still lots of agriculture happens in that area. So it's around 13 k's east to west, 21 k's north to south, about 53 kilometres going around the lake. It's 215 metres below sea level, and it's up to 43 metres deep. So that's one of the reasons that the way the water is so treacherous in a storm like we're having tonight, where the wind is able to whip up the waves because it's not that deep, not like the Mediterranean, which has, I discovered this week, has a deepest point of 5,670 meters and the average depth of 1,500 meters. So at 43 meters, you can see that the Sea of Galilee is much shallower. Now, when we look at the geography of Mark seems to love geography. He tells us almost every paragraph has a marker telling us where this event took place, way more than any of the other Gospels. I went through all of the Gospels just looking for these markers, these points to say, where did this event happen? So there are 62 of these in the Gospel of Mark, a few less in that in Matthew, even though Matthew is nearly twice as long as the Gospel of Mark, so there's mid-50s. There's only about 30 in the Gospel of Luke, and a lot of those are really vague. So Luke will say, this happened in a certain place. Jesus was in this particular district. He doesn't go into the detail, whereas Mark likes to give us that specific kind of detail. And what we see when we're looking at that first few chapters in the ministry of Jesus, they're marked out there on the left as he passed along the Sea of Galilee and went to Capernaum, went to a desert place, returned to Capernaum. He was beside the sea, he entered the synagogue, he departed to the sea, he went up the mountain, he went home, he began to teach beside the sea, he went across the other side, he came across the other side, he went down to the country of the Gadarenes, Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side. There's lots of crossing, lots of movement in and around the Sea of Galilee. So this is the ministry of Jesus that we see in these first six chapters of the Gospel of Mark. He doesn't give us any time indication. None of the synoptic Gospels really tell us how long all of these events take place. It's only in the Gospel of John that you get any hint at all about the 3 years of the public ministry of Jesus. The other Gospels, there's no seasonal markers, there's no feast day markers, there's nothing to indicate when any of the events take place. Only John has that. So we have all of this movement. And then chapter 6, verse 1, the gospel that we have tonight, we're told he left that place and came to his hometown. Nazareth isn't even mentioned in the text at this point. It simply says to his patria, to his home place. So it's a much more significant distance, about 40 k's by walking from Capernaum or Capernaum down to Nazareth. So it's a couple of days' walk. So you're wondering, you know, why did he go on this journey to his home, to his hometown, taking his disciples with him? So those disciples are on tow. So it's not just going home to visit mum. There's obviously something more. He's wanting to do something different in this town. And so the teaching in the synagogue is very significant. Nazareth, we know, is a bit of a rustic town, so that's why I put the rustic slide up there. So this hometown with his disciples, and as we've seen before, any male was able to teach in the synagogue. It was up to the assembly president to organize a preacher on the particular day. So when Jesus turns up in town, they probably would have heard something about him, so he would have been invited to teach. And so he sets to teach in the synagogue, the assembly hall, on this particular day. And is he welcomed? No, he's not. Now, Nazareth, you probably have seen in the Gospel of Matthew that Matthew, when they describe that Mary and Joseph had been down in Egypt and they had to go there because of the persecution of King Herod, and then they were able, once Herod had died, to return back to Jerusalem was their intention, but because the son of Herod was there, they weren't able to settle in Judea, and so they continued up to Nazareth, to Galilee, and they settled in Nazareth. And in Matthew 2:23, we're given this line, what is spoken through the prophets would be fulfilled, that he will be called a Nazarene. I don't know if you've ever been a Bible geek enough to actually go searching through the Old Testament to see, well, where in the Hebrew Scriptures is this prophecy that he will be called a Nazarene? You know, what is this prophecy being fulfilled? What is Matthew referring to here? And if you look through the pages of the Hebrew Scriptures, will you find the name of the town Nazareth? No. Nazareth didn't even exist in the time of the writing of the Old Testament. Nazareth is probably only about 100, maybe 150 years old at this point. The Galilee was really only settled in a significant way after the Seleucid Empire of the Greeks had kind of done their deed and allowed that establishment of that town. And so it became a place that was settled only in more recent times, certainly. So it's not mentioned at all. What is mentioned is this word Nazir. And so a Nazir is a branch or a stick. And you might recall that prophecy that is made in the prophet Isaiah chapter 11, that there will be this little branch that will begin to grow from the root of Jesse, from the line of David, that the Messiah, the Messianic tree, will begin to be challenged deeply, and the line of David might almost die out, but there will be this one little branch that will begin to grow, and that will be the sign of the Messiah coming. And so the word for branch or stick, as I've got up there, is this word Nazir. And so Matthew hears in Nazareth this echo of Nazir, this whole sense of the fulfillment of that prophecy. And so Jesus, he says, will be called a Nazarene, which means simply he will be a branch man or a stick man. And so when in the Gospel of John, we get that line that Nathanael is perplexed that Jesus is from Nazareth, he's like, Nazareth, how could anything good come from there? Because Nazareth literally, in that Hebrew way of understanding the world, means up in the sticks. It's this stick place, this stick, you know, he's from the sticks, literally. So if you want to say that someone's from Bega or Burgo or something, you would say, oh, he's a Nazir, he's from the sticks. And so this is what this describes. So it's no wonder that Jesus is just from the sticks. How can he be any good? How can he be this prophetic figure? How can he be the sort of one that all these people are talking about him? So it's no wonder that the people are perplexed by him. Not only that, he would have dirty hands. He would be grubby. Because where did the man get all this? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? And they say, after all, he's only a carpenter. In the Greek, it's called this, a tekton. Now, that can be a carpenter, but it's certainly not someone who just primarily and only works in wood. Most of the houses would have been built from clay and mud and stone and brick, just whatever they could kind of get their hands on. So it's perhaps better understood as a handyman or just a jack of all trades, a craftsman of some sort, being able to build almost anything. A tekton was a very versatile kind of person. And just for the geeks here, the whole sense of where do we get the word architect, it's from that Greek. So a tekton is a craftsman, and then the architect is the chief craftsman. And so architecton just comes from that. So it's a beautiful kind of reference also. Remember in the Gospel of John when Mary Magdalene is there and she sees this person in the garden and doesn't recognize Jesus, and she says to him, thinking that he's just the gardener, and saying, you know, where have you hidden the body of Jesus? And it's a beautiful image that, well, Jesus is really the gardener because he's planting this new life. He's establishing this new possibility. He's all about the new creation. He's also the craftsman. He's also the one that's able to fix things. He's also the one that's able to establish this true life, that when our hearts are broken, we go to the tekton. We go to the tekton from Nazareth in order to bring healing, to fix us up, to restore what is broken. So yes, he is the tekton, the carpenter. And Jesus is amazed at their lack of faith. It's a perplexing kind of question. We often see this, that Jesus, of course, has the power to do whatever he wants. But there's always this reciprocity. There's always this desire to enter into relationship with the people that he's healing. If he sees but just a little spark of faith, that is always enough. That's all he needs to be able to do this work. But he's always longing to see that faith in us. He's wanting to see that expression. He's longing for us to begin to manifest something of that return, something of that desire, so that he has something to build with. It's something that's sorely lacking, of course, in our church, this desire and this ability to really be open to this power of God being at work in our lives, to let God do this work, to long that he will be able to fulfill this call, to bring about this new creation, to restore the brokenhearted, to bring this healing that is so necessary into our world. Yes, the world needs it. And the world needs us to be people of faith that say, yes, look at us, Lord. Look at our faith and our desire, and look at our willingness to respond in turn to this desire and to enkindle this faith within us and to be instruments of faith within the world. So Paul recognized in our second reading from 2 Corinthians 12 tonight, that whole sense of that fragility, these things in his heart and his life that he wasn't able to be faithful to God. And yet he said that in my weakness, that there the power of God is able to be revealed. It's not about knowing it all and having it all together, but it's simply that desire and that recognition that, no, I'm weak and I'm small and I'm frail. But unlike the people of Nazareth, to simply be open and to say to God, help my unbelief. Help me to be a person of faith. Help to restore that faith, that through me you might indeed bring fire to this earth.